TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness.
Adam Shapiro, the International Solidarity Movement and the War in Palestine. At a time when the threat of U.S. war in Iraq looms large and many think about ways to respond, two very courageous examples of nonviolent resistance come to mind. One is the work of Kathy Kelly and the members of Voices in the Wilderness. They are building Iraq action teams of internationals that will take up residence in major Iraqi cities. Their plan is to put their bodies in the way of a military attack. The other example comes from occupied Palestine. Throughout the last year, you may have heard news reports by and about the so-called internationals from the U.S., Italy, or Japan doing peaceful, nonviolent resistance in Palestine. They were seen riding with ambulances, accompanying food shipments, and chaining themselves to houses slated for demolition by the Israeli army. Today's speaker and co-founder of the International Solidarity Movement, the Jewish-American Adam Shapiro, was even seen in the besieged office building of Yasser Arafat. He tried to help evacuate wounded Palestinians. Nobody knew how he managed to get in through the cordon of Israeli tanks. Adam Shapiro and his Palestinian-American wife, Huwaida Araf, are co-founders of the year-old International Solidarity Movement, or ISM. The ISM is calling for an end to the Israeli occupation of the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem. Adam Shapiro spoke at the University of California, Berkeley. He begins by acknowledging that we in the U.S., unlike the public in Europe, are presented with a limited view of the Israeli-Palestine conflict. Here is Adam Shapiro.
The standard view is that this is a conflict of Israelis versus Palestinians, or sometimes presented as Muslim versus Jew. And as such, it's interpreted as a conflict of identity, giving rise to fear, intense fear, that leads to, in the interpretation, self-defense actions. In fact, the action last night in which 12 or I think now 14 in the numbers up to Palestinians were killed in Gaza was described as a self-defense action when an Israeli helicopter fired into a crowd of Palestinians on the streets in Khan Yunis. But I can tell you from my experience and from being there that that framework just doesn't really apply properly. The framework that I look at it through, and I think that makes more sense, is a framework of one in which the split and the divide is not between Israelis on one side and Palestinians on the other, but rather those who wish to oppress and maintain a system of oppression, known in this case as the Israeli occupation, and on the other side, those people who want freedom, who want to live their lives in peace, to raise their children in security. When presented in these terms, you can't just divide right down the middle, Israelis on one side and Palestinians on the other. Rather, you have to divide between those who have interests in continuing violence and continuing the system of oppression and continuing the cycles of retribution and revenge over and over and over. And on the other side, you have a mixture of people, and I would argue a great majority of the people, who wish to have genuine peace and genuine freedom. Now, understood in that context, we can make an assessment of the current situation on the ground, which is not something new that began in September 2000 with the beginning of the Intifada, but rather was a continuation of now a period of time since 1967 and even before, but in particular the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza since 1967. And even with the so-called peace process of 1990, it began with the Oslo Accords in 1993, those those agreements did not end the occupation. In fact, it gave it a new context in which to continue. So the system of oppression, the system of occupation, existed before this intifada and continues to exist, and in fact is entrenched now in a way it hasn't been entrenched probably ever, because there hasn't been a period of time that Palestinians, the great majority of them, have been living under curfew, locked in their homes, under full military occupation with tanks and helicopters and the F-16s deployed against the civilian population the way it exists now. Understood in these terms, then, the struggle among for the Palestinians is not a struggle to wipe out the Israelis, but rather to wipe out occupation and oppression. And as such, this is very much a struggle for freedom. As a struggle for freedom, it is a struggle that anybody around the world, including Israelis, can identify with and can support. And that's the basis in many ways for the international solidarity movement, and I'll get into that. I don't like to use too many analogies because I think the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the current situation of occupation is quite unique. But if we look at the example of South Africa, black South Africans were not expected to make peace and develop reconciliation with white South Africans while a system of apartheid continued. The principle was one person, one vote, and when that was achieved, South Africa could be reconciled and can move forward into the future. With this conflict, with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, we are approaching it as if we need to achieve peace, and that is where the focus is. And I agree, we need to achieve peace for both peoples. But first, before we go for peace, we need to achieve freedom. Because, as in the case with South Africa, we cannot expect, and certainly we even have now the historical proof, that a peace process, that a negotiation to establish peace, will not work as long as there is a continued system, an entrenched system of oppression. I think if we look at this conflict from those terms, it changes much of the way we consider what is happening in the occupied territories. The international solidarity movement was founded on the principle, as I mentioned before, of supporting a Palestinian freedom struggle. And in particular, it was founded to support a nonviolent Palestinian movement, which does exist and has existed for many years, most notably during the First Intifada, back in the late 80s and early 90s. This was perhaps the height of Palestinian nonviolent resistance. But this resistance is not alive and well today. And as some of us internationals who are living in the occupied territories during the Intifada, as the Intifada unfolded, discovered, there could be a significant role for internationals in supporting this nonviolent movement. First and foremost, our participation in supporting Palestinians and working with them to resist nonviolently, be it through popular marches or removing roadblocks or nowadays breaking curfew, walking in the streets, going to school. First and foremost, we found that it has an effect on the level of violence Israeli forces use against Palestinians. They will shoot at Palestinians and use lethal force against them and use the excuse of self-defense or hunting down terrorists to justify it. But when internationals participate and our presence is known, and we make our presence known because we want the world to pay attention, Israelis will use only tear gas or sound grenades. Occasionally they'll use rubber bullets, but for the most part we have found that they won't use lethal force. Not that Palestinians don't expect, and not that we don't expect, there to be risk in using nonviolent resistance, because after all, it still is resistance. It still is a threat to the system of oppression. But nonetheless, we found this can be a very useful tool. The ISM was forced into, in a way, taking on another role as the invasions of city by city in the West Bank began in late March, early April. And as the system of curfew and full military occupation unfolded, we realized that humanitarian aid, be it provided by Palestinian relief organizations or international organizations, was simply not getting through. That the Israeli military in its attempt and so-called war on terror was in fact locking up and punishing an entire population in each of these cities. In Nablus, I think during the very first military occupation in April, the city was locked down for, I think, 13 days straight, 24 hours, 7 days a week. People weren't allowed to leave their homes. But back in April, we found that if people had to get to hospital, if people had to get bread, if people had to receive medicine that they normally receive by going to the pharmacy, it required the internationals, those of us civilians who were there, to step in and fulfill this role. Because although the United Nations is supposed to be respected internationally, and although the Red Cross is supposed to have access even in war-like areas, the Israeli military quite simply prevented these organizations and others from accessing the Palestinian people. And in some cases, including a UN food shipment and a Red Cross medical truck, shot at these humanitarian workers. Now, I have my own issues with how the UN and Red Cross operate in terms of what they are willing to accept as how their missions are defined and by who. But we decided on the ground that this is an intolerable situation and we would have to challenge this based on the principles of international law, international humanitarian law, and basically just out of what is right. This notion that people, Palestinian people, should not be punished simply because they're Palestinian. And when we talked about this in the media, because many of us were interviewed back in those days, because we were the only people walking on the streets and the cameras were rolling around looking for somebody to interview, this made a big impact, I think, from the emails I got. It seems to make a big impact with people, but the response was that we, the internationals, were terrorists. That we were, if not ourselves terrorists, we were aiding terrorists because we were providing them food. Now, the Israeli way of presenting its case is that, again, it's fighting a war on terrorism. It's echoing what, you know, the United States is saying. And as such, when it goes in, like it did last night, into Khan Yunis, it's carrying out operations, and that makes everybody a target. I have no doubt Israelis fear for their lives. I have no doubt that they're afraid to go to movies or to ride on buses or to go to cafes. I empathize and I sympathize with this fear. Last night in Khan Yunis, when an Israeli tank rolled in, it fired a missile into a home, and the missile went right through a bedroom of a home. Luckily, five people usually sleep in that room, they were all up on the roof because they heard the soldiers down on the ground, and they were afraid, so they fled up to their roof. So luckily, they were only injured, and they weren't in their room when it was shot. But can you imagine a missile coming through your bedroom wall or window, or whatever? This is everyday occurrence. For Palestinians, it is not safe to live in your own house, even though that is where you're confined 7 days a week, 24 hours a day at times. This is why the struggle has to be understood that it's a struggle for freedom. Because the fear that exists on both sides is not a fear that is born out of Israeli going after Palestinian or Palestinian going after Israeli. It's a fear that is born out of a system of oppression and occupation. That is the foundation for this fear on both sides. Unfortunately, I don't think Israelis understand this for the most part, although I think it's slowly starting to develop a little bit in certain circles. But more importantly, maybe not more importantly, but equally as importantly, I think in this country, Jewish Americans don't understand this. There is starting to be a movement among Jewish Americans, notably a person who I met from the Columbia University, Bruce Robbins, who's started a petition, one of the people starting a petition, to differentiate between the actions of Israel and support for Israel from Jewish Americans. It's an important break. What they're saying is that the actions of, they do not support the actions of Israel in continuing this occupation and oppression. This is a significant break because it's a significant rejection of this framework that I was talking about, this paradigm of understanding the conflict. And I think this kind of movement has to happen on a much bigger scale. As somebody pointed out to me today, earlier today, there are 75% of Americans who've been polled who say they support the establishment of a viable Palestinian state. Now, I don't think 75% of Americans are willing to go out and march in the streets for it, and I don't think they're willing to take too much action, but in their gut, when asked, they feel that they support the establishment of a viable Palestinian state. So there exists in this country public opinion to support the ending of occupation. An occupation, we need to acknowledge, that is supported and in many would argue maintained by the extraordinary amount of aid given to Israel's military and financial support for the Israeli state. We need to accept and understand that our taxpayer money is going to support this system of oppression. Additionally, in Israel, it's been noted by people who conduct these polls that there are 60% of Israelis who support, or 60 or more percent of Israelis who support, are willing to end the occupation. So even in Israel, even at this time when people are fearful, there exists the support, the public opinion, for ending the occupation. So the question is, if this public support exists and has been measured and documented, how does that fit into our understanding? And I think, again, we have to go back and assess that this is a very intentional policy by the Israeli government and by the U.S. government to maintain a system of occupation and oppression. A system of occupation and oppression that is creating fear, that has created fear, that has created complete insecurity for everybody, and a situation in which the only way to overcome it, the only way, is to acknowledge and to move on ending the occupation immediately. I don't think that ending the occupation means peace. Rather, I think ending the occupation means freedom for both Israelis and for Palestinians. After that, we can talk peace and we can negotiate peace. And in that, I urge all of you, in whatever way you can and whatever way you will, to do what you can to support that, to support the ending of the occupation, to raising consciousness and awareness that as Americans we have a significant role in supporting it. With the Israeli-Palestinian case, we've all been watching and tuning into this for years. So we can't claim not to be familiar and not to have some impact on our lives. We need to change how our radar is interpreting this so that we can take the proper action to ensure that we can establish first and foremost, again, freedom, and then peace. I just want to conclude by saying the ISM, this is one of the most important developments of this intifada, in that more than ever, it is making clear to people who come, and then when these people return back home in Europe, in the United States, in Japan, in Korea, wherever they come from, when they speak out and talk about their experiences, it's becoming clear to others that this occupation has to end. Thank you.
That was Adam Shapiro, co-founder of the International Solidarity Movement, the ISM. He spoke at the University of California, Berkeley in October 2002. A lively question and answer period followed. Specifically, people in the audience wanted to know Shapiro's opinions about Palestinian rights to self-defense, about suicide bombers, and the settlement of Israelis inside occupied Palestine. The first person commenting said he saw parallels of the international solidarity movement with the civil rights movement in the U.S. Here, without further interruptions, is a collage of several answers given by Adam Shapiro.
I'm glad you pointed out the analogy of Mississippi, because that was actually our inspiration for the idea of bringing internationals, and also we called our campaign this summer Freedom Summer Palestine. For myself as a student of the civil rights movement, it especially was a very important linkage to make and strategy. This summer, one of the things that we found ourselves having to do, literally chaining ourselves in homes that were due to be destroyed by the Israeli army, to bring attention to the fact that this is collective punishment, that this is a violation of, you know, human rights, humanitarian law. We were able to bring this issue to the attention of the media, of human rights groups, of political people. You know, like letters went out to Congress people to raising awareness. Caterpillar, for instance, the company that provides the bulldozers, sells them to the Israeli army. You know, they received letters from people and pictures of people chained in homes to protect these homes from them being destroyed. I certainly agree with the principle of self-defense. And I think self-defense is defined in large part by how the kind of force and violence that is being used against you. For instance, I believe that the Palestinians, when the Israeli army invades a city, have the right to defend their city with whatever weapons they have at their you know, disposal. The invasions of these places, including the Jenin refugee camp, were invasions of civilian areas where people live. And anywhere in the world, people have the right to defend their homes. I firmly believe that. I must say, I do not support the use of suicide bombings. I think it is morally wrong. I have studied Islam. I have spoken to many Muslims. Many Muslims tell me that it is not part of Islam. And I have to say, most important, maybe not most importantly, but certainly ranking up there, having lived in the Palestinian society, I fear what the use of this tactic and strategy will do for a future Palestinian nation, for the future Palestinian community that will come into existence as a state one way or another. And I fear what this tactic will do for the social fabric of a Palestinian community. I firmly believe in the power of nonviolence. I do think that a nonviolent movement can only achieve so much, and that ultimately there's going to have to be some element of negotiations involved to end the occupation. I'm not even talking about making peace, I'm talking about ending the occupation. I think a nonviolent movement, though, can be extremely useful and extremely important in clearing the way to getting to that point. And I also think a Palestinian nonviolent movement would generate an Israeli nonviolent movement as well. We need to acknowledge that while the world is calling for Palestinians to be nonviolent, nobody's calling upon the Israelis to be nonviolent, and they are certainly not nonviolent. And actually, more importantly, what I want to point out is that we need not just nonviolence, we need actually direct action. We need confrontation through nonviolence. And what that means with Palestinians taking apart roadblocks, breaking curfew, those sort of things. For Israelis, I would suggest, and I've suggested this to Israeli activists, it means going to the settlements. A massive, you know, Israeli peaceniks going to a settlement and demanding that these people return home and demonstrating at a settlement. It's great that they have 70,000 people march in Tel Aviv, but to me that's not enough. I think they need to go to the settlements and tell these people to come home. The argument is that I've made with Israelis and that I think other people are starting to make is that if they would pour in that kind of attempt to secure the border, the 67 border between the West Bank and Israel, for instance, then Israelis could have security inside Israel, but get rid of the settlements. There was a general who came out with an Israeli general who came out with a report that was quickly covered up in Israel. And he was making the argument, this is our best possible security that we could have. And again, this I don't know what happened to him, but his report was quickly... it appeared for a moment on like the Haaretz website and then disappeared like an hour later.
That was a collage of several answers given by Adam Shapiro, the co-founder of the International Solidarity Movement, or ISM, after his talk at the University of California, Berkeley, in October 2002. Shapiro, who is Jewish, ended by specifically welcoming fellow Jewish Americans to go to Palestine and see for themselves what the reality of Israeli occupation looks like. He also encouraged Palestinian Americans to join the ISM. His wife and co-founder of the ISM, Huwaida Araf, is Palestinian American. For many, the young couple are an example of a new generation that will overcome the legacy of violence and help bring about a peaceful solution to the war in Palestine. You can get in touch with the International Solidarity Movement by going to their website, www.palsolidarity.org. That's palsolidarity.org. Or you can find a link on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can get information how to order a copy of this program with Adam Shapiro. That includes a very moving talk by Kathy Kelly from Voices in the Wilderness, by calling us. TUC Radio is listener-supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number, 877-TUC-TAPE, translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelaiden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.